This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. A bill moving rapidly through both chambers of the Florida legislature would transfer permitting authority for proposed development of wetland habitat from the federal government under the Clean Water Act to the State Department of Environmental Protection. Proponents say the measure is meant to eliminate a state-federal redundancy and won't impact protections for Florida's wetland ecosystems, but environmental advocates worry it will weaken those protections. We'll take a closer look at the bill later this hour. But first, as we kick off week 7 of this year's state lawmaking session, our legislative roundtable series continues in a conversation with State Senator Kathleen Passidomo. She represents Florida's Senate District 28, which covers portions of Collier, Hendry, and Lee counties. We spoke last Thursday morning, less than a day after the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland that took the lives of 17 students and adults at the school. Unbeknownst to Senator Passidomo, as the shooting was taking place, she was presenting a bill in committee aimed at improving mental health services in Florida schools. Our conversation covered a broad range of other legislative priorities for the Naples Republican, including education funding, affordable housing, elder abuse, and a proposed pilot project here in Southwest Florida aimed at better addressing the needs of newborns suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome and their families. Let's hear that conversation now. I just wanted to start off and wanted to get a response, your response from yesterday's mass shooting at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland.
You know, of course, you know, we are in shock and just almost no one can speak because what the parents of these students must be going through is just reverberating in the Capitol. And, you know, there's not much you can say. Any words you say are trite because of what they're going through. Parenthetically and almost prophetically, I have a bill, my big committee bill for my committee, my pre-K through 12 appropriations committee, I was presenting to the committee just as this was occurring. And in my bill is a brand new categorical in our budget for mental health assistance for the districts. Part of the what happened early when I took over the committee in September, a number of superintendents, including Superintendent Renzi from Broward County, met with me and said their number one problem, their number one issue was students with mental issues. Not so much mental illnesses, but all kinds of problems that, you know, you just classify as mental illnesses and or mental issues. And that we needed to create a systematic way to deal with this issue. So I had a workshop, and we talked about it, and we got suggestions. And so we put together a categorical in the bill, in the budget, that would provide funding for the districts to create a plan on how they were going to address the students that had that showed these issues, from bullying to gang stuff to all kinds of problems that kids have. Because, you know, the problem is, and I said this, and I was presenting it as this was occurring, I had no idea. That 19-year-old young man was not born that way. And I said it yesterday, and I've said it a dozen times today. Something happened, likely when he was younger, you know, in the younger grades. And there was only one place that could have addressed that or could have found it. It was in school, because that's where the kids are. And had we had a system in place to identify that problem that early, to divert him from whatever issues he was facing, it may not have happened. And one of the things that we have in the bill is for the districts to create a plan and to create a partnership with the mental health facilities, that if they do identify these students, that they get them help, they send them to counseling. And I know this student had some counseling, but I wonder if it wasn't too late. So, you know, for me, that's just a paramount priority, and we need to pursue it, and I've been talking to people all day about it, and hopefully we're going to be able to move forward and do something that this will never happen again.
Well, and just as a caveat to WGCU listeners hearing our conversation, this is actually being recorded less than 24 hours after that mass shooting. So by the time this airs on Monday afternoon, you know, we anticipate knowing a lot more. But do you think that this incident might pretty much cement that this effort of yours is going to pass, is going to be included?
Well, I hope so. You know, we have a long road to hoe because, frankly, I was able to get $40 million in our budget, but that's just not going to be enough. And so I'm going to go back to my colleagues and go back to the House and see if we're willing to put some more dollars into this because, you know, we need to address these issues early on. I mean, I can't say anymore. And the biggest the thing that's most troubling to me is that Florida is one of the worst states in the country for funding for mental health. And so these kind of things have happened. And if we could intervene early on the lives of these people, they won't become monsters that they are today. The Pulse nightclub shooter, this young man, it's reprehensible that if we don't do something soon.
Do you think that this shooting might in any way impact future legislative debates or even the bills that get filed in future sessions as they relate to firearms?
I think it'll probably create a discussion. It's interesting that I, you know, over the past several months, I've been speaking with school officials that different viewpoints. Some believe that there should be no firearms ever near campus, et cetera, et cetera. Others feel that it would be beneficial to have certain designated individuals, obviously school resource officers, trained police presence, so that there would be some additional security that could prevent this kind of event. You know, so I think the dialogue needs to occur.
And, you know, while we're on the topic of education, I wanted to, you know, switch gears just a little bit here and stay on education, but maybe talk more about funding. The House and Senate have passed competing budgets, you know, that aren't really very far apart at all when it comes to dollar amounts, but they're kind of far apart philosophically on how we're going to pay for services like schools and affordable housing.
Sure.
And I just kind of wanted to get your response to, you know, this House Bill 7055 that was recently approved, a sweeping public education bill. One of the things that it does is creates this new private school voucher program, the HOPE Scholarship, aimed at helping students who are victims of bullying be able to attend a private school to sort of escape that situation. And now you have supporters of this bill saying, you know, this is a great way to address this very serious issue of bullying, which, again, is linked to the mental health issue we were just discussing before. Opponents, though, say it's not really addressing the problem of bullying, and it just seems more like a further effort to put more taxpayer dollars toward private education instead of public education. And as chair of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Pre-K through 12 Education, I'm particularly interested in hearing your insights and observations on this broader issue of using taxpayer dollars to fund private school voucher programs and whether or not we should be embracing this school choice philosophy in terms of using more public dollars to fund private education.
Well, it's a very complicated issue, but let me just try to boil it down. First of all, I think we have two parts of this. One, we have the student who's bullied, and we have the bullier. So let me address the bullier first, because there has been a lot of people saying, why are you not addressing the person who does all the bullying and et cetera? Frankly, my bill, that's what would occur if we had these mental health programs, because we have to address students that are bullies because there's a reason they're a bully. And I think that everybody acknowledges that and wants to work on that. Whether this student that committed this horrific crime had been expelled and was in an alternative school. So we have to address that, and in my bill is a start with that. The second thing, the student who's bullied. Now, here's the problem in my mind. If you are attending a school and you've become a victim and you've been bullied or whatever, there are a lot of kids that are not comfortable in that school. Even if you did stop the bullying, there's a history there. And so I'm very supportive of allowing that student to make the choice to move to another school to start fresh so that they don't have that baggage on their shoulders. It makes it to give them, you know, the lift that they need. And it's not we are advancing paying money to private schools. They could go to another public school, to a public charter school. I mean, there's it's not black and white as it's being portrayed. So my whole focus is on the student. If that student is uncomfortable in that school, even if they're not being bullied anymore, they have a history there. Everybody knows they're the person that got bullied. So I actually support that. Now, here's what the Senate did on that School of Hope bill. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't just, you know, one incident and then a student moves away. We basically put in provision that there has to be sort of a notice and an opportunity for the district or the school to make it better. And that makes sense. So let's talk about this HB 7055. I read it, and it's long. I read it twice. I had to read it twice. It's really, there's some very good parts to it. The problem that we hear is that the people who are against it haven't read it, or they're being told information that's not strictly correct. Now, there's some things in it that I disagree with how they're addressing it. There's some things in that bill, for example, that are in my bill, that it's a great concept. It's just how you approach it. In my bill, we have something called a franchise principal model. So if you have a really great, high-performing principal that has capacity, why not let them keep their own school that they're doing such a great job at? And if they have capacity, let them take on a well-performing school, because they're obviously really good. There's some people that are very capable. So that's the franchise model. Pay them more, let them do a couple of schools. In the House, their model that a lot of people are decrying sort of creates a whole new structure. But the concept is there. It's just how we execute it. And so, you know, these are the conversations we're going to have. There are some provisions in that bill that people are very supportive of, with regard to Title I funding and some other things. So it's a work in progress, and, you know, I'm committed to making sure that whatever we pass is something that is in the best interest of our students. I'm not looking at it from what's in the best interest of the administrators or the unions or the even the teachers. Actually, I have put in my budget a salary increase for teachers that would, you know, I think everybody's been asking for. So I just looked at it holistically, and I think that the comments about that bill are largely, many of them, I should say, are inflated.
I do have to say, it's nice to hear you say you've read the bill, because it's no small feat. It's 200 pages. I'm still working.
Well, it was counting. Well, and you know, it's complicated. This whole low-performing school issues and school grades and the like is complicated. I had to create a chart to a time frame, and, you know, arrows and all this other stuff to put it in my mind as to where we're going. But and there's some provisions in there that I would like to see changed, and so, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit, and I wanted to talk to you about something that you had discussed with us shortly before session began, and this regards the Sadowski Trust Fund, and that's mm-hmm. money that's slated for affordable housing. Tell me about the situation here and what's been happening with this money in recent years.
So when the Sadowski bill was passed, I forget what year, 20 years ago or so, it provided that a percentage of the documentary stamp tax on real estate transactions would go into a trust fund that would be used for affordable housing. And it, for the first couple of years, that's what happened. Well, the legislature then got into the habit of what they call sweeping it, taking some taking some of those funds and using them for other purposes. And that's been going on since I've been elected, at least. And it has been troubling to me because for two reasons. Number one, as an attorney, I know what a trust fund is. It's funds that are put, that were created for a particular purpose and should be used for that purpose, not for anything else. So I have always wondered why we were raiding or sweeping the Sadowski funds. But secondly, in our day and age, when we're talking about affordable housing daily and communities are trying to work on affordable housing plans, we could use those funds. So I filed a bill this year that would that basically would prohibit the legislature from sweeping the trust funds. And I had one hearing, and so far it passed unanimously through its first committee. The House, one of the representatives filed the same bill in the House and has not had any hearing. So for all intents and purposes, it is the bill is not going anywhere. Now, that being said, I think that we've accomplished two things. One, we've made the issue front and center. And not only that, it also became a Senate initiative. And when we created our budget, we did not take any money in our budget from the Sadowski Trust Fund. So our budget did not sweep any of the funds. Now, the House did sweep several hundred million from the Sadowski funds. Some of it actually is for affording housing initiatives, so I guess that's an okay thing. Will we end up not sweeping it this year? It's the only time will tell as we go through conference. We may have to take it to meet the House budget. But I'm okay with that concept because I'm not one of those black and white, it's all or nothing, it's my way or the highway. It is, we need to put it on the table. We need to have that conversation. We need to start somewhere. And if we don't get to the finish line this year, we'll come back next year and take another look at it and keep looking at it until we accomplish something. So I feel good about having raised awareness in the legislature that this is not what we should be doing.
I'm wondering how this issue first came up in your mind and why you decided to champion this. Because, you know, as you know, in the Naples, Collier County area in particular, affordable housing is a challenge there. And, you know,
absolutely,
we hear all the time.
Here's the interesting thing, too. You know, those funds are there, but they have to be applied for. And we have been almost in a, frozen. The funds are there. Apply for it. Come up with a plan. Come up with a program. Collier County, we've been talking about for 20 years. Longer. I've been in Collier County since 1979, and we were talking about affordable housing even back then. So we have to have a local initiative to apply for those funds, and it has to be a program that comports with the confines of the statute. So, whether you sweep it or not, the different issue is apply for it. Come up with a plan. Come up with a program. Don't just talk about it. We've been talking about this. We have a task force every year that meet and talk, but nothing has been accomplished. I'm happy to say that I think this cycle, the county commission is just bound and determined to get something done, and I hope they do.
Another legislative effort that I've been looking forward to speaking with you about since session began, creating a neonatal abstinence syndrome pilot project here in Southwest Florida.
That's such a great idea, and I have gotten it through every committee. It is ready for its final stop to go to the floor, and the House won't hear it. And that's all I have to say. I'm just devastated by that.
Well, tell me about the concept itself and what it would do, or I guess.
Well, basically, we have an opioid crisis in this country. And unfortunately, we have babies that are born opioid addicted. And they, of course, are when they're born, they're in the neonatal intensive care unit in the hospital, which is probably the most expensive real estate in the world. for obvious reasons. And these babies have to suffer through withdrawal. I mean, it is heart-wrenching. It takes 7 to 10 days where, can you imagine? I've never experienced any kind of withdrawal, but I've heard it's a terrible experience for an adult. Think about a baby. They cry for 24 hours. When they're not awake, when they're not asleep, rather, they're just crying. And so part of the problem is in the NICU, the unit, the nurses don't have time to hold these babies. So we have volunteers that come in, and they call them snugglers, and they hold the babies who are just crying and crying and crying as they go through withdrawal. Well, the hospital, once they're done that, they really need a step-down program, because a lot of these kids can't go home. These babies can't go home because they have addicted parents. And some of them have addicted grandparents. And even if the parent wants to go straight, imagine the stress of having a brand-new baby and yourself going through withdrawal. So this program would create a program outside of the hospital where the babies would be the actual clients, not the parents. The babies would be in the facility, a home-like setting, with having, obviously nurses there, but volunteers who would be with the baby and do the cuddling and do the nurturing that the parents at that point are not able to do. And we could provide the wraparound services that the babies need, getting with Healthy Start and those kind of things. And also the parents could get into some parenting classes. There's a lot of these young ladies that have never been a parent before. So anyway, it's a very complicated bill, and we had a new license classification and a whole bunch of other things. And I worked with Lee Memorial on some language, health issues with the babies. And it was, we worked really hard on it, and it just wasn't heard in the House, and there was a bunch of reasons. And then they said, well, they don't like new licenses, and we changed it. I mean, this went on and on and on, and ultimately they decided not to hear it. So, you live to fight another day. I'm going to come back next year. I'm going to file the bill again, and I'm going to hope that the House will hear it next year.
I know in my own conversations with Lee Health neonatologist Dr. William Liu, he's telling us, right, the rates of babies born here at Lee Health hospitals with neonatal abstinence syndrome have increased a stunning 1,200% since 2005.
Yeah. It's awful. It's just part of the whole crisis that's affecting this country. And there's another part to it, too. If we do the step-down program, and these babies, so right now these babies have nowhere to go because we don't have foster families to take these babies. They have to stay in the hospital. The average length of stay could be 30 days, and that costs about $100,000, and which obviously we taxpayers pick up. Having them in a step-down program would be a lot less expensive because you don't have, as I said, the most expensive real estate in the world is the hospital. I mean, you get disappointed, and then this is the process. Come back next year, at the start earlier. We kind of were a little late starting, and I know the House had other priorities, but we'll get through, and I'm confident I'll be able to work on it next year.
Let's talk about another bill you've sponsored, Senate Bill 1562, addressing elder abuse. This creates a cause of action for an injunction for protection against the exploitation of a vulnerable adult. What's this all about?
Well, part of the problem we have now, we have a number of many of our older citizens are under guardianships, and the clerk's office basically manages that process. And they are finding that a lot of times the guardianship reports are not accurate, and they want to be able to do random audits. That's one bill I got. Oh, you were talking about the exploitation. So here, that's one bill. We're doing that random audit so that they can make sure that the expenses are proper.
Gotcha.
The second thing is we have seen the citizens in facilities where the nursing home people are noticing that the family members are just basically robbing them blind. They get their names on their checking accounts and bank accounts. And so what this bill would do would be if that is suspected, that they could go to the court to put a temporary freeze on the banking accounts and checking accounts so that they couldn't be depleted. And that's happening all over. I mean, family members are the worst offenders. And it has to go through a judicial process, but at least it gives a temporary hold so that any exploiter can't continue to exploit. And actually, it's not just family members. It could be others. And I think this will go a long way to safeguarding the assets of our senior citizens who are so vulnerable to financial abuse.
And, you know, I know that you're also on the Statewide Council on Human Trafficking. I haven't seen anything that you've filed specifically that relates to the issue, but I know it has been a hot-button issue just in the news in Florida and in session. Is there anything you can tell me about that you're addressing regarding human trafficking or that you're following?
Being a member of the committee, of course, I'm following all the issues. I have not filed any legislation. We have a number of members of the legislature that's like their number one thing, and I support them fully and help in any way I can to advance legislation. And every year we just move the needle a little bit in different ways, whether it be criminal penalties on one hand, notice requirements on the other, simple things like one of my favorite bills that passed a couple of years ago was that all the rest stops would have a sign. If you're a victim of human trafficking, call this, or, you know, just simple things. There's one bill this year that I'm a little uncomfortable with, and it's strict requirements on hotel employees to report suspected human trafficking. And that's hard because, you know, how are we going to manage that? So I'm going to take a look at that bill. It hasn't come before me yet, but that's out there. That might put a burden on some people who really just don't know. So we'll see how that goes.
And your colleague, Senator Lizbeth Beniquisto, has been, championing this ban on minor marriage in Florida.
Right.
We recently saw the House vote for a bill that would – it supports this, but there's a caveat in there. It carves out an exception for 16 and 17-year-olds when there's a pregnancy involved and neither partner is more than 2 years older than the other. Is that an exception you're okay with?
I'm going to live with that. I think I understand that. You know, of course, it's unfortunate. I get why they're supportive of it, because you certainly, especially when you have a baby, that you should have two parents. But, you know, are you setting them up for failure? Honestly, if you're going to do that, I would have put a whole bunch of things in about counseling and parenting classes and other things, because a 16 and a 17-year-old having a baby, it's tough enough to be a teenager, let alone being a parent. So those are things that, you know, you want to follow carefully.
That's kind of daunting to me now. I can't imagine trying to manage that at 16.
Right. I mean, I had enough trouble in my 20s.
Right.
27 when I had my first son. Like, you know, we forget how hard it is to be a parent. These are somebody said babies having babies.
Well, one of the purposes for having this legislative roundtable series and had these one-on-one conversations with members of Southwest Florida's legislative delegation is to really let our listeners get to know their lawmakers. So something I've kind of been asking everybody is just if you can tell me a little bit about, you know, your life prior to becoming a state lawmaker and why this is something that you continue to do. I mean, you were term limited out of the House, and then you won another race in your district in the upper chamber, and you're one of the most prolific bill filers I see.
Well, there's a few that file more. I practiced law in Naples for, 39 years, and when I first moved to Naples in 1979, I was one of there were only two other women lawyers than me. And, of course, because I was a transactional lawyer, I wasn't a trial lawyer. So, I did business and real estate and whatever. I was a target of every nonprofit that ever existed, because I could do bylaws and articles of incorporation and minutes and, you know, whatever. So I became very much involved in almost every nonprofit or business, charitable civic organization. And, you know, over the years, so many things that we were dealing with had a question, well, can we do this or not do that? Oh, only the legislature, you know, and it was all related to what was going on in Tallahassee. So when the opportunity arose in 2010, I ran, got elected, and I at the time we were in the foreclosure crisis, and I had had some experience, you know, in my practice of dealing with foreclosures, and realized at the time that the foreclosure laws in Florida were archaic, outdated, and didn't work. So my mission was to reform Florida's foreclosure laws, and it took me 3 years and a lot of help, and we got it done. And, you know, once you start doing stuff like that and you feel like, wow, I've been able to make a difference, you just come up with the next thing. And I also got very much involved with legislation to protect our most vulnerable citizens, at least in my mind, our elderly. Most everyone is filing bills to do stuff for kids or whatever, but you know, the forgotten segment of our society are older folks, and we have so many of them, and in Southwest Florida. And so every year I did one or two bills that would help protect them. So that's how I got involved, and I keep on going. I'm like the Energizer Bunny.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
That was Naples Republican State Senator Kathleen Passidomo, representing Florida's 28th Senate District, which includes portions of Collier, Hendry, and Lee counties. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we'll be taking a closer look at a bill advancing in both the Florida House and Senate that would transfer permitting authority for future development on sensitive wetland habitat in Florida from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to the State Department of Environmental Protection. Supporters of the bill say it aims to eliminate a redundancy in the permitting process, but environmental advocates question the DEP's ability to take on the additional workload and worry it will result in weakened protections for Florida's wetland ecosystems. That's just ahead. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. Stay with us. Welcome back to this week's Legislative Roundtable edition of Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. A Florida Senate committee last week advanced a bill which aims to place a longstanding federal program protecting wetlands through the Clean Water Act under state control. Right now, under the Federal Clean Water Act, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers holds permitting authority when it comes to proposed developments on environmentally sensitive wetlands in Florida. This designation is known as dredge and fill permitting authority under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. However, companion bills moving rapidly in both chambers of the Florida legislature would put such decisions in the hands of the State Department of Environmental Protection. Bill sponsor, Republican Senator David Simmons of Longwood, says that if approved by the EPA, the legislation would simply eliminate a redundancy in the development permitting process for freshwater wetlands.
This is permitted by federal law so that the state can administer without duplication with federal law itself, the Section 404 permits, but the actual implementation and of this and the execution of this program will be done as if the DEP is the is acting as the Corps of Engineers, and will be done in accordance with the requirements of federal law. There will be no lessening of the requirements for these dredge permits.
However, environmental advocates here in Florida disagree. They say that the Florida DEP is already resource-strapped and question whether the agency will be able to take on the additional workload. They see this largely as an effort to fast-track the permitting process for developers looking to build in wetland habitat. I recently caught up with Conservancy of Southwest Florida Senior Environmental Policy Specialist Amber Crooks for a closer look at the bill and its projected impacts. Let's hear that conversation now. Please just tell me about this bill, because I got to tell you, I've read through the four pages of the bill language and I don't see the word wetlands anywhere in there.
Yes, it reads like a complex bill. Basically, in a nutshell, though, it's going to be transferring the Clean Water Act responsibilities of wetland destruction permits from the federal entities to the state of Florida. And the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and many others believes that's a bad idea.
Yeah, I read a recent editorial in the Tampa Bay Times from Tony Aguilani. Basically, my takeaway from that is that this seems to be just a way to kind of fast-track the permitting for development of environmentally sensitive wetlands in Florida.
Yeah, that's what DEP and the bill sponsors are promoting this bill. You know, this is a priority for the department to see this bill go forward under the idea that this is going to streamline and reduce duplicative programs. But we don't see it that way. In fact, we think this will result in reduced environmental review and reduced environmental protection of some of our most critical environmentally sensitive lands that provide not only ecosystem services to us in times of flood or hurricane, but also provides habitat for our diverse wildlife that we have here. Most all of them rely on wetlands as part of their habitat. And it also helps cleanse our water before it reaches downstream points. So wetlands are really important to us. That's why Conservancy has been working on protecting our wetlands and also trying to stop major development in our sensitive wetlands for the past 50 years.
So why should we care about wetlands?
Well, just to name a few things in addition to what I mentioned, a 1 acre of wetland can actually store about 1 million gallons of water. So when we have a high water event, a flood, that can actually help with storing water and allowing it to percolate into our groundwater supply or ease the flow downstream. And regulate that and flow downstream. It also helps cleanse our waters. And, you know, it's an essential part of Florida's ecosystem. South Florida, in particular, has major wetland ecosystems that are a part of our natural history that people like to recreate in and around. So anything that's going to streamline or fast track development in those essential lands, we would be opposed to. And we see that with this bill. There's a couple of other reasons, too, to be concerned about this bill, from a practical standpoint and a legal standpoint. So there are several major reasons why the Conservancy is opposed to these bills. One is that we believe there are three local, state, and federal layers of government for a reason. And we have actually seen the federal entities, even though their track record is not perfect by any means, producing better results for the same projects that they're reviewing as a state. So a state and the federal entity get a wetland permit application. We've actually seen the feds taking the time to produce a better result for the environment.
And so just for the record, this federal section 404 dredge and fill permitting authority, that's under the Federal Clean Water Act, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And currently the Army Corps of Engineers is the federal entity in charge of these permits?
They're the major entity, yes. And so like I say, even though they're not perfect, I mean, most all of the entities, whether local, state, or federal, they very rarely say no to a development. But in several cases, the federal entities have produced better results. For example, in 2011, just in 1 year, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection permitted over 10,000 acres of lime rock mining in our Lee Coyer area, just not too far from here. And in the same time frame, the Army Corps of Engineers said, wait, hold up a sec. We actually think that this is too many wetland impacts, too great of an impact on our wildlife habitat and to our groundwater supplies. This is a very sensitive area of Southwest Florida. We need to stop, not issue any permits, and actually do a full environmental impact statement under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And that's actually one of the laws that would no longer be triggered in the same way should the state take on this responsibility. There are other federal laws that actually it's very unclear and uncertain how they'd be complied with should these bills take effect.
I'm just confused about how the Florida legislature can sort of unilaterally decide to make this decision about a federal act.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. These bills will definitely pave the way for them taking on this responsibility, but the feds at the EPA do need to approve that. So there is still some negotiation and approval process after these bills, should they be successful.
And have you heard anything from them? Are they on board with, you know, giving up this authority to the DEP?
Well, it sounds like they're in talks. We have actually had direct conversation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're remaining neutral about this. But in other states, where there's only two where this has been taken on so far, there are concerns about whether or not the Endangered Species Act has been fully complied with, and also how those states are shaping up in actually enforcing the Clean Water Act the way that it was intended. So this would really be quite a change from Florida's previous position. They actually looked at doing this in 2005, and they found that the cost and the uncertainty and the complexity of the federal laws were reasons to not take on this awesome responsibility of a Clean Water Act 404 permitting program. And other states, almost about a dozen other states, have looked into doing this and have decided not to pursue this because of the same issues.
Do you know off the top of your head what the other two states are that have done this?
Yeah, Michigan and New Jersey are the only two other states that have taken this on so far to date. And almost immediately, there were some issues on ensuring that those states had the actual up-to-date federal laws that they were enforcing, and questions about whether they were really implementing the Clean Water Act up to the standards they should be, and also about how to handle endangered species issues.
Interesting. So yeah, if we do pass this, it wouldn't be unprecedented. We'd certainly be an outlier, and we can look to other states that have done it and seen potential problems down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the 2005 attempt at this, that decision that they eventually made to just dump the idea came after some pretty intense analysis. Is that being done this time around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not getting a sense that there is much analysis going into this. It sort of came out of left field by the time most of the environmental community had heard of this proposal resurfacing now 13 years later, was when this bill's already passed at least one of its committees. So it was a bit of a surprise. And now clearly a majority of the environmental community is raising red flags and concerns about these bills going forward. And I think in part it's in reflection of this lack of environmental review and protection that we see, but also in regards to the capacity and workload of the current state of Florida wetland permitting agencies. We know that they're already strapped. The growth has already increased, and we know just for the state's program that they're having a tough time keeping up with the flux of permitting applications. We're not sure how they could take on this additional responsibility, and DEP has testified that they're not planning to provide additional money for implementing this program. So that means not only would they not be staff not be trained on the Clean Water Act and the differences between the state and federal requirements, but they also would not have the additional staff capacity to take on applications. And that's really concerning because it's not just about permitting projects, it's also about enforcement and compliance, which is also a big responsibility.
So do you think that perhaps putting this responsibility in the hands of an already resource-strapped state agency is really just setting the stage for, you know, future lawsuits for violations of the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act or you name it?
Well, that would be a concern. We're, of course, worried, you know, from a practical standpoint, will they be able to do a good job with a lack of capacity? And also, the state of Florida, you know, not to be negative about some of their staff people because they're doing an awesome job in the environment that they're in, but the state of Florida does have a different culture we've seen than at the federal level. The state of Florida, you know, they recently in the past few years passed a different bill to reduce the amount of questions that reviewers can ask of developers, limited the amount of times they can ask those questions, so they may have to actually rule on an incomplete information. And also where they've been limited to really investigate some of these issues deeply. So that Army Corps process is really providing a sort of a checks and balances, independent entity application of the Clean Water Act that is necessary to be retained.
Gotcha. And, you know, who's behind this proposal? I mean, I can look and see who's sponsoring the bill, but I mean, is this just really, you know, the interests of developers here that want to fast track permitting?
Yeah, it seems that the only real benefit from this bill would be development interests, and they have shown up in force at the committee hearings, because we don't see any benefit of this bill for, you know, the general public, certainly not for the environment, and even not for the agencies themselves, because they will be taking on quite a bit of responsibility and workload in order to actually implement this program.
And with the caveat that this could, you know, all change by next week or even tomorrow, what's the current status of the bills as they stand now in the House and Senate?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the bills are pretty far along, and that's unfortunate because even though DEP has been quick to answer our questions over the recent weeks, it was quite far along before we really were notified of these bills being introduced. And from a public records request, we know that they've been working on them from many months ago, even. So all told, the environmental community is a little bit late to the game because we weren't really incorporated into the process prior to these bills being proposed formally. So it has a few more steps, but considering that this is a Florida Department of Environmental Protection priority bill, we think that it's likely it'll be on those agendas and make its way pretty swiftly through the process.
Yeah, so that's, yeah, the fact that we're more than halfway through, It's moving rapidly.
It's moving rapidly. And then also, the Conservancy of Southwest Florida has an action alert available on our website, which is conservancy.org, to write the governor and let him know that we don't support this wetlands bill.
And we did cover this before, but I just want to make sure I'm clear here. If this does pass the legislature, do we know what kind of specific federal action would have to take place in order for the Army Corps to, you know, officially and formally relinquish control of this permitting process?
Right. If these bills do pass and the governor signs this bill, then DEP will be working over the next several months to fashion agreements and work on a submittal to the EPA. And then there is a public commenting process. So, you know, there is more to be done by the public and the Conservancy at those points to let them know that we're not supportive of that going forward in the future.
So it is possible that even if this passes the Florida legislature, the EPA could potentially say, no, we're not going along with this. Your State Department isn't going to be capable of doing this properly.
That's a possibility. We may have to cross that bridge when we get there. I know that there is perhaps some desire to, you know, reduce the federal workload. That might be one positive thing they see of doing this. But of course, it's on the public and on us, the Conservancy, to let them know reasons why it would not be appropriate for the state of Florida to take on this responsibility. One, perhaps being not only the capacity issue, but also the fact that the state of Florida has challenged legally the Clean Water Rule in the past. And that was a rule that was going to clarify wetland jurisdiction issues on the federal level. So they actually had challenged the very bill that they're going to need to use to implement this program and determine which wetlands they're responsible for. So that seems, you know, not congruent with they're wanting to take on this 404 program.
And again, as you had mentioned, there were some dozen other states that had considered something similar and then after looking at the evidence decided not to go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think also,
like Florida did too,
the Endangered Species Act questions will definitely be a big part of the discussion for the state of Florida because we have a lot of endangered species in Florida. We're one of the most biodiverse places in the nation. And that is a very significant part of the Army Corps' decision making that then the state of Florida would have to coordinate if these bills move forward. And I think there's a lot of unresolved questions with that.
I think it's also worth noting a lot of our biodiversity is composed of flora and fauna that don't exist anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And you know, looking at the list, there's really only a few that are in the drier areas. Most of our wildlife species especially on our protected list, rely on wetlands as part of their essential habitat.
Well, is there anything else you'd want to add at this point, Amber?
There's just a couple other things. You know, one of the concerns that also popped up is that DEP doesn't anticipate a big growth in our state of Florida. And we actually, in Southwest Florida alone, are anticipating 500,000 people over the next 20 years. So that's another reason we're concerned about this lack of capacity and lack of funding, is that their FDAP is not really recognizing the potential for growth, especially in Southwest Florida. And the other things I wanted to mention, John, were that we have seen better results, by and large, from the federal entities in permitting. They all end up saying yes at some point, but we actually have seen many projects being approved through the federal process. I mentioned that in 2011, the DEP had issued about 10,000 acres of lime rock mining projects, whereas the Army Corps actually said, hold up, we need to stop and do an environmental impact statement. Additionally, in 2002, the FDEP permitted a project called Mirasol right in the middle of the Cocahatchie Swamp, right next to Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary, whereas the Army Corps actually had denied that project a few years later. So those are some examples of where we've seen the federal entities taking the time necessary to push back on developers and actually produce a better result.
Do you think the development interests who are maybe in favor of this and want that quicker permitting process are sort of missing the forest for the trees? I mean, yes, this might enable them to build projects faster and make money faster, but if they're just increasing capacity for human development and then we've destroyed all the land where those people are supposed to get fresh water from, mm-hmm. where's that going to leave us?
Yeah, that's a major issue. We've seen, even with Hurricane Irma, the importance of wetlands for our natural infrastructure. You know, it's taking up some of those storm waters. It's helping with the storm surge, or especially our coastal wetlands. And it's providing cleaner water. So there is immense benefit to keeping intact wetland ecosystems, you know, not only for the environment itself, not only for the animals that call that home, but also for our quality of life and for the security of our communities.
Well, Amber Crooks, thank you so much again for taking the time.
Thanks, no problem.
That was Amber Crooks, Senior Environmental Policy Specialist with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. That's all the time we have for today's program. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and yours truly. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.